Well, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas.
I want to call your attention to the notes tonight. First page. There's an upcoming class schedule there, so wanted to remind you of the upcoming class schedule. We're going to be off until next year.
Oh.
The week from tonight is Christmas Eve, and so I thought about having Christmas anyway, but I got overruled, so no classes Christmas Eve, no classes New Year's Eve, and then the next week is the Missions Conference where I plan to be in Murrieta, so I can't be here. So resume, I think is where you spell it. Resume class January the 14th. Everybody got that? There'll be some out here next week knocking on the door probably, and I mean, there always are, because not everybody gets the message, I guess. But anyway, just so you know that, that's what the plan is. Now, tonight we have a long study. You'll see there's only 10 pages of notes this week. So, you know, if you've got in habit of memorizing the 8 pages, it'll give you a little bit more to do. But chapter 20, this is Job's final discourse after the comments from his three friends. Eliphaz and Bildad commented 3 times, and Zophar 2 times. They're done. We won't hear from them again until we hear what God has to say about them at the end of the book. But in this 6th chapter discourse, in chapter 26, we'll be talking about man's frailty. Job will be talking about man's frailty and God's majesty. And then in chapter 27, he maintains his integrity. That's a great chapter, I think. That chapter is quite an interesting chapter when you look at the commentaries, because some people look at the commentary there as Job being such a remarkable man, and I'm in that camp, and he's a real example, a real encouragement to me. But others look at it as he is very prideful, and he is very into God's face, and he's not behaving the way he should. And of course, Job does do some of that in this book, because he is really hurting, and he just longs to hear from God, and he doesn't hear from God, and then he kind of goes nuts in a way, and he goes all the way down, and he's down in the dumps, you know, and then he comes up with these great revelations, and then a little later on he's down again. But what would you do if you'd lost 10 of your kids, and if you lost everything you had, and if you had boils all over you and worms crawling out of you and months in this condition, your skin and bones, your skin's all coming loose, and I mean, how would you have done? How would I have done? I wouldn't have done very well. And yet, in all of this, we don't see him blaspheming God. Now, somebody says, well, does he ever sin? Well, Job never said he was sinless, because there's no sinless people, right? Everybody sins. But he was, we're going to read, where did we start with this? I just want to let you know again, remind you what God said about Job in the beginning here, before this test with Satan came up. Job 1:1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. That's God speaking. So if God calls a man blameless and upright and one who feared him and shunned evil, he's got my attention. That's a good guy. That's not some run-of-the-mill, down-and-out, wicked man. That's a good guy. And so then he picks him out to throw him into Satan's equation, where Satan says everybody's just a hired mercenary. Nobody loves you for who you are, God. Everybody just worships you and loves you because of what they can get out of it. And so then God said, okay, you consider Job. Take everything that he has, but don't touch him personally. And so he did, and Job did not blaspheme God. He took all 10 kids in an hour. Can you imagine? I mean, I know some people, and you must know some people, who've lost one child. And I mean, and that just is more than you can bear. He loses 10 children immediately and everything he had. And he was a man of great possessions. But he didn't blaspheme God. So a little later, they're gathered again together. Satan says, yeah, but you know, you just took the things away from him. You haven't touched his body. Touch his body, and anybody who's in real pain is going to curse you to your face. Chapter 2, he still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without a cause. So Satan answered in verse 4 of chapter 2, the Lord and said, skin for skin, yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. So God tells Satan, stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and Satan says, he will surely curse your face. Lord says to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. Immediately now, what does Satan do? He doesn't wait around. He goes, boom, right to him, breaks out with these painful boils from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head, and they turn into infection and worms coming out of him, and he's in this terrible pain for months, we find out. But still, he doesn't curse God. But Satan is relentless as he is with you. Now, Satan is such a loser, right? Anything Satan is going to try to do, ultimately, he's going to lose. He's defeated 2,000 years ago on the cross. We read in the book of Hebrews, Christ went to the cross and defeated Satan. But Satan is left there as he is in this particular account here, in a sense, as the alternative of choice to God, as the destroyer, as the deceiver that he is. And so Satan now is going to use these three friends of his. He plants in Eliphaz, the oldest guy, this spiritual vision that basically says anybody who's suffering is a wicked person. That's the reason they suffer. So by the time Eliphaz gets there with his two other friends, Bildad and Zohar, and they apparently talk this over or have or whatever, and they all come up with the same assumption. Righteous people prosper. Wicked people suffer. Job, you're suffering. Look at you. You're such a mess sitting here in the dump in the ashes. With smelly, you stink. Nobody can be around you. And you can't even look at you. You're so bad. They didn't even recognize him. He looked so bad. So therefore, you're a wicked man. You're in sin. And they keep pounding away. And so with the lesson pretty much up till this point has been one of how not to comfort people. If we take the lead from Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad, that's how not to comfort people. They never pray for him. They never put themselves in his shoes. They never ask him how he feels. They just pound away. Job, you're in sin. And then it gets worse. Second time around, he says, first time around, you may be in sin. Second time around, you're in sin. Third time around, they say, you're doing these specific sins. They're all bad sins. If you were doing those, you're a wicked person. No question. They're right in that. But Job hadn't done any of those. And so next time we meet, next year, we're going to get the last throw of Satan, and that is this guy Elihu, and he's going to have basically the same thing. He doesn't really come up with anything significantly new, but he builds a stronger case that you should be blaming God for this because God is a liar if you're righteous as you say you are, because he wouldn't be blaming you, or he wouldn't be persecuting you or having you suffer if you were really blameless the way you say you are. So he's really trying to undermine his faith in God. That's Satan still at work. But we'll see that Job, with God's grace, gets through all of this without cursing him. So let's look tonight now in chapter 26, where we'll start this sixth chapter discourse. And I thought we should at least have one Christmas carol, because we won't meet until after Christmas. And on page 10 it is. This Isaac Watts carol, Joy to the World, and the music originally by Handel. I really like the third verse here. He rules the world with truth and grace. That's the second coming, isn't it? Now we sing this at Christ's coming the first time at Christmas, but it really doesn't fit. Jesus is not yet ruling with truth and grace, and makes the nations prove that will happen with his second coming, but it hasn't happened yet. So we can sing this in praise and thanksgiving for his first coming, and we can sing it with looking forward to his second coming. So let's sing along here, or you can listen to the music, whichever you prefer. And Joy to the World. Okay, Job chapter 26, beginning his sixth chapter discourse, and the first four verses here, in responding after Bildad's last and final speech, he talks about man's frailty. It says, Job answered and said, and he basically is asking the question, have you helped him who is without power? Have you saved the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? How have you declared sound advice to many? To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit came from you? Now, I think this is fairly clear. He is coming back at Bildad because Bildad was giving a bunch of answers to questions that Job hadn't answered, and all three friends had been fitting this comforting failure here with they haven't helped him, they haven't saved, they haven't counseled, they haven't declared sound advice, and there was no good Holy Spirit coming from any of them. So, you know, he's kind of, they're at this point really kind of going back and forth with great intensity. And so that was his answer to his friends. And now he goes on and talks about God's majesty. One thing is very interesting. This is Old Hebrew. And as we mentioned before, this is, we believe, to be the oldest book in the Bible. It was preceded only in history, I believe, by the first 11 chapters of Genesis. So this goes way back. And many of the Hebrew words in Job are not used anywhere else. And so people don't really quite know what they mean. They think they can try to figure it out from the context and stuff, but they're not really sure. And so what we have here in verse 5, the dead tremble, those under the waters, nobody really quite knows what that means. It could be referring back to the flood, which wasn't too long ago. But anyway, the dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol is naked before God, and destruction has no covering. Now, this is an amazing statement in verse 7. Listen to this. He, God, stretches out the north over empty space. Now, it took us thousands of years after this to find out the magnetic center of the earth is the North Pole. And so it's believed that in God's creation, it kind of started at the north and came down from that or whatever. And here is what he says, that he stretches out the north over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing. And that was an amazing statement. It will be about 3,000 years before Sir Isaac Newton had an apple fall out of the tree and hit him on the head and he discovered gravity. So they thought in the old days that the earth was held up by, first it was an elephant, and then they were saying, well, what holds up the elephant? Then they said, oh, a turtle. A turtle's holding up the elephant. So then what's holding up the turtle? And they said, oh, well, it's Atlas holding up the turtle. But they could never figure out anything out. But they didn't know how, something had to be holding up this earth, right? Otherwise, it'd just fall down. Well, Job has already come to the conclusion, divinely it would seem to me, that he hangs the earth on nothing. Isn't that amazing? Amazing revelations in this book that you would never come up with in a way. Listen to this. He binds up the water in his thick clouds. The hydrological cycle is absolutely another one of the phenomenal things of God's creation. It's estimated that 1.5 trillion tons. 1.5 trillion tons. Can you imagine how much that weighs? I can't. I mean, it's just too big. That's the estimated amount of water that falls to the earth each day around the world. 1.5 trillion tons. And of course, if 1.5 trillion tons is falling each day, that means there's roughly that evaporating each day from the ocean. So God gets the moisture back up into the air and the wind blows it on back over land, and then it drops there again. And we talked about that. It forms on these little particles, tiny, tiny, tiny particles, and then with some electrical disturbance, these particles come together and then they form drops, and the drops have to be just the right size to fall, but not so big that they would come down and crash through and kill everything on earth. It has to be a gentle rain. Otherwise it kills everything, right? It's just unbelievable. Anytime you look at any of these things that God is doing, it just blows your mind, doesn't it? So he binds up the water in his thick clouds, that the clouds are not broken under it. He covers the face of his throne and spreads his cloud over it. Now here's another one. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters. They all thought it was a flat earth in those days. Remember, even Columbus 1492, they thought, well, we don't have any maps. You're going to maybe go out there a ways and you're going to fall off the end of the ocean. It's going to end out there and you just boom, drop off. But he already coming up with the idea that God drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. So this kind of means you can see that at sunrise and sunset, it would seem. The pillars of heaven tremble. Mountains apparently tremble with earthquakes, right? How would you shake a mountain? I mean, unbelievable. They are astonished at his rebuke. He stirs up the sea with his power, and by his understanding he breaks up the storm. So tremendous power in the sea, and tremendous power in the storm, and Job is attributing that to God stirring that up. I love this verse. By his spirit he adorned the heavens, or beautified is another word there. By his spirit he beautified the heavens. And if you have ever been out from light pollution for a while, you got to be out of a big city, but then you look up on a clear night, and particularly if the humidity is low, and I mean, it's just, the skies are amazing, aren't they? Just what we see with the naked eye, let alone if you look at some of the Hubble telescopes things and so forth. So he adorns the heavens. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent, or Rahab, probably referring to Satan. Indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways. So Job is saying, we know a little, but we only know the tiny bit. And isn't that true even today? We only know a little bit about the edges of the ways of God. How small a whisper we hear of him, but the thunder of his power, who can understand? So Job is answering them now. And later, you know, when we get to the end, God is going to answer Job in full, all about creation. But Job is already, you know, he's really mindful of creation here, as we see so many references here in which were really years and years before man ever figured this out, or at least before we have any record of it. Now, chapter 27, as I mentioned earlier, he's going to maintain his integrity, and I just really admire him. I don't see pride here. I don't see him bragging here. I just see him stating his position that I'm really confident before God, and if I could just get in touch with God, if I could just get face to face with him, he would agree that, you know, I haven't been wicked in terms of trying to sin. In fact, now I do make sacrifices. He was making sacrifices all the time. He knew he needed to repent. He needed to be sacrificing, and he did it with his kids every time they got together. So he knew that he was not a perfect man and he was sinless. That's not what he's saying. But he's saying, I'm not in the wicked category that you guys are saying. And so even after the very first go-around with him losing his materials, and then when he got really second go-around with all this pain, what did his wife say? Why don't you give up your integrity and die? Curse God and die. So she was a big help, you know. had his wife and then the three friends, and they're all telling him what a sinner he is, in a sense. But here he's maintaining his integrity. He continues and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter. Now, he's upset with God because he doesn't hear from God. So he's going to be some blaming some God here, which isn't right. And in fact, that wasn't right either, because it says that he says, God has made my soul bitter. That's not really where the bitterness came from. As long as my breath is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, listen to this. My lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Can you say that? I wish I could. Far be it from me that I should say you are right, you guys. I'm not going to agree that you're right, that I'm in deep sin. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. Now, man, this is a man who's not that far from death. I mean, he is really in bad shape, but he is saying, I will not put away my integrity as long as I have breath. I think it's such a strong statement. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Now, we know self-righteousness is as filthy rags in Isaiah 64, but we're under a different covenant now with Christ because he paid the price for our sin, and we cannot achieve salvation by righteous perfection. The only way we can achieve salvation is to believe in him who is righteous perfection, and we have that righteousness. But this was before the time of Christ, and he is just saying, I have not been in wickedness. May my enemy be like the wicked. He who rises up against me like the unrighteous, for what is the hope of the hypocrite? He's talking about the wicked here now, that he may gain much if God takes away his life. Will God hear his cry when trouble comes upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? No. Will he always call on God, the wicked? No. I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. So he's going to just tell him what he has seen in God, and it's not that he's the only one that sees it, because he says, surely all of you have seen it as well. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? So Job's kind of getting back at his good friends there, because of the way they're coming at him. He's just calling them, they're behaving with complete nonsense. Then he says, this is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it's for the sword. Even if he has many kids, they'll be killed by the enemy. And his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. His kids will go hungry. Those who survive him shall be buried in death, and their widows shall not weep. So, apparently there are some funerals where the widows are not too sad that their wicked husbands are gone. At least that's what he's saying here. Though he heaps up silver like dust and piles up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the just will wear it. He won't end it up with his clothes. Somebody else will take them. And the innocent will divide the silver. He builds his house like a moth, like a booth which the watchman makes. It's just temporary. The rich man will lie down, but not be gathered up. He opens his eyes, and he's no more. So the wicked man may be rich and all, but he is going to die, and he'll be no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away and is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him, and he shall hiss out of his place. In any way, he's saying that the wicked will be mocked by others when it's all done, and he will be no longer. Now, in chapter 28, he's going to talk about wisdom, and he's going to compare it with how hard we work, for example, physically to get things, where we should really be working to get wisdom with that same intensity. He says, surely there's a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadow of death. Mines, in other words. He breaks open a shaft away from people in places forgotten by feet. They go down, way down, and nobody's walking down there except the guy working in the mine. They hang far away from men. They swing to and fro. And as for the earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. I think he's talking about volcanic activity there. Its stones are the source of sapphire. So you go down and dig and you'll find precious minerals and precious stones. It contains gold dust. A path that no bird knows, no bird flies down there, nor has the falcon's eye seen it. It's all underground. The proud lions have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He puts his mouth on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks. This is all the things man does in trying to get rich with the minerals. And his eyes see every precious thing. He dams up the streams from the trickling. What is hidden, he brings forth to light. Sounds like the 49ers panning for gold, doesn't it, in the old days? But where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man knows not its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me. The sea says, it's not in me. Wisdom cannot be purchased for gold, nor can silver be weighed for its price. It cannot be valued in the precious gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Neither gold nor crystal can equal it. Nor can wisdom be exchanged for jewelry of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or quartz, for the price of wisdom is above rubies. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. So he's speaking very highly on wisdom. Verse 20, from where then does wisdom come, and where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, we have heard a report about it with our ears. And here's the answer. God understands its way, for he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heavens. to establish a weight for the wind. Now, this is a great statement as well. For years, nobody thought the air weighed anything. But now we have barometers. What do they measure? They measure the barometric pressure, don't they? To establish a weight for the wind and apportion the waters by measure. And I read this one, so I wrote it down. On 1 inch of rain on 1 square mile, that's 640 acres, you have an amount equal to 1.650 billion gallons of water. I mean, you just so much water, you can't even imagine it. He apportions the water by measure. When he made a law for the rain, a path for the thunderbolt, then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it. Indeed, he searched it out, and to man he said, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding." That is such a significant idea. We're told it first in Deuteronomy 4:6, then almost directly quoting it in Psalm 111, verse 10, and in Proverbs 1:7, Proverbs 9:10, and essentially it says that in Ecclesiastes 12:13. So in those five other scriptures, it says this. So this is a significant scripture in the Bible. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, or is the beginning of wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So underline that. If you don't have it underlined in your heart, that's good advice, and it will fit Old Testament, New Testament forever. We want to depart from evil, and we want to fear God. Now, he is going to go, these next chapters here, he's going to summarize his position a little bit. You might just say, "I rest my case," is what he's going to say. And so he continues now in verse 29, and he's going to be reminiscing and remembering the things earlier. He's kind of, in his own way, remembering the good old days. But they're not really the good old days. They're days just a few months ago. It's not like three or four generations ago, right? I saw one quote that Spurgeon made that I really like regarding the good old days. He said that far too many people remember their blessings as if they were written on sand, and they chisel their sufferings in marble. "My sufferings I can remember, but the good things, I forgot about those." That's not the way we should do it, but that's the way we can do it. So he says, "Oh, that I were as in months past," Job says, "as in the days when God watched over me." The when, he's remembering when. In fact, that's used 11 times right here in this chapter. "When God watched over me, when his lamp showed above my head." Oh, those were the days. He longs to have that fellowship with God. You remember a time or two ago he said that he cherished the Word of God more than his daily food. You know, he'd rather have physical starvation than spiritual starvation. And he's really hurting here because he's in such physical condition that it is so unbelievable, but yet he doesn't hear from God, and it's just so hurting him. "As in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, when by his light I walked through darkness, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent." Now, does that describe your life now? Can you put yourself in that picture, not of Job saying when years and years ago, but today? Is that happening in your life? Are you aware of God watching over you, that his lamp is shining upon your head, his light is walking you through darkness? "When the friendly counsel of God was over my tent," or over your house. Is the friendly counsel of God over your tent right now? "When the Almighty was yet still with me." Job, you're not quite right there. He still is, but Job didn't know it. "When my children were around me." Oh, my 10 kids that are gone. It was so wonderful. I'd get together with my children, and now they're gone. I can't even imagine that. "When my steps were bathed with cream," that just means with blessing, "and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me." My. "And around other people. When I went to the gate of the city, he sat there as a judge," apparently. "When I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid, and the aged arose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed. Their tongues stuck in the roof of their mouth. When they ear heard, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw, then it approved me, because I delivered the poor who cried out. So he is saying the people were treating him really, really well. But look, he's also stating some of the things he did. I delivered the poor who cried out. And this is, again, a good checklist for you and I. How much do these things fit our lives? Delivering the poor who cried out, the fatherless, the orphans, and the one who had no helper. The perishing man came upon me. I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind, and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and I searched out the case that I did not know. You know, we always need to do that. You know, it's so easy to come to a quick decision when we don't know the whole story. But he searched out the case that he didn't know. And a lot of these are kind of legal terms, because Job apparently was kind of doing some legal work there sitting in the gate. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth. So you can look at that as being prideful, I guess. You can look at that as kind of bragging a little bit. But I kind of look at it as just justifying that there's not wickedness in me. I mean, I'm not suffering because of wickedness. I just can't, I can't buy that. Verse 18, then I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow, or my strength, is renewed in my hand. Here's where the people were paying attention to me in those days. Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After my words, they did not speak again. That didn't quite happen with Bildad and Eliphaz and Zophar. In those days, they waited for me as for the rain. And then they opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it. And the light of my countenance, they did not cast down. I chose the way for them and set as a chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army and one who comforts mourners. Wow, that came full circle there, isn't it? Because as these three friends were unable to give him any comfort, he's remembering back to the days when he was held in high esteem by people and so forth. And he said he was one who comforted mourners. And so now, would you give me a little comfort, kindness? It seems to be remarkable, just a remarkable testimony there. Now he's going to go contrasting the good old days as he reminisces with now. But now, but now, but now. We've got now in here several different times. Verse 1, chapter 30. But now, contrast. Everybody, they mock at me, men younger than I. And in that culture, the younger always held the older in high esteem. But he says even the younger ones are mocking me. Whose fathers I disdain to put with the dogs of my flock. These were rotten guys. I wouldn't even put them with my dogs in my flock, let alone with my flock. These are the sons of those. They're mocking Job now. Indeed, what profit is the strength of their hands to me? Their vigor has perished. They are gone from want and famine, fleeing late to the wilderness, desolate and waste, who pluck mallow by the bushes. He's just saying these are the low life. They have nothing to offer, and yet they're mocking me. And broom tree roots for their food. I don't know how many of you are on a broom tree root diet. But I bet it works. I bet you lose weight on it. They were driven out from among men. They shouted at them as a thief. They had to live in the clefts of the valley, in caves of the earth and rocks. Among the bushes they brayed, under the nettles they nested. They were the sons of fools, yes, sons of vile men. They were scourged from the land. And now I am their taunting song. Yes, I am their byword. They abhor me. They keep far from me. They do not hesitate to spit in. Now, this also reminds us of how Jesus was treated, doesn't it, to a degree? But spitting in the face was about the lowest thing you could do. And these are young men spitting in this older man's face. Because God has loosed my bowstring and afflicted me. Well, he's looking at that way, and it really is. He's in the clutches of Satan right now in this position here, really. But he's thinking it's God because God hasn't answered him. They have cast off restraint before me. At my right hand the rabble arises. They push away my feet. They raise against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They have no helper. They come as broad breakers under the ruinous storm. They roll along. So he is likening these ne'er-do-well young men coming against him like a great big breaker would come in the middle of a big storm. It just comes like that, rolling along. Terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my honor as the wind, and my prosperity is passed like a cloud. We know here that he lost everything, all his donkeys, cattle, sheep, everything, servants, and so forth. His prosperity has passed like a cloud. And whereas before he was reminiscing, he says, verse 16, and now my soul is poured out because of my plight. The days of affliction take hold of me. My bones are pierced in me at night, and my gnawing pains take no rest. My drawing pains take no rest. By great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about as a collar of my coat. Nobody quite knows what that means, but I guess he couldn't get comfortable in his clothes. This is so painful. He has cast me into the mire. Of course, he's sitting there in the ashes. Well, next thing he says, and I become like dust and ashes. Yeah, that's what he's doing. He's sitting there in the ash heap in the dump. But now he lifts his head a bit and he says, I cry out to you, Lord, but you do not answer me. Again, it's that plaintive cry there where he just wants to hear from God. I cry out to you, but you do not answer me. I stand up and you regard me, but you have become cruel to me. I don't think that's true, but it looks to him like it is. Lord, what are you doing to me? He's saying. With the strength of your hand, you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on it. You spoil my success. I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. So here he's just, you know, at the end of his rope again. He's just really down, 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 and he's just crying out to the Lord, you must be behind this. I have no other solution. Surely God would not stretch out his hand against a heap of ruins if they cry out when he destroys it. Have I not wept for him who is in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? When I looked for good, evil came to me. When I waited for light, then came darkness. My heart is in turmoil. I like the old King James there. He says, my bowels boiled. My bowels boiled and cannot rest. Days of affliction confront me. I go about mourning, but not in the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I am a brother of jackals, or probably a dragon, and a companion of ostriches or owls. Listen to this. My skin grows black and falls from me. It's just rotten flesh, skin just black and falling off. My bones burn with fever. He's got a very high fever. Oh, how miserable that must be. My harp is tuned to mourning, and my flute to the voice of those who weep. Now in chapter 31, his last chapter here, he's going to build a case like an attorney. He wants to go to court again, kind of a thing. But listen to what he says. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Some say that should read, I have made a covenant against my eyes, that they would not look upon a young woman. So whether you made a covenant with your eyes not to, or you made a covenant against your eyes, the point is this. He's made a covenant not to look upon a young woman. He recognizes lust and the difficulties that it causes. For what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of Almighty from on high? Is it not for the destruction of the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does God not see my ways and count all my steps? I'm sure he does. If I've walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened deceit, in a sense, then let me be weighed on honest scales, that God may know my integrity. If my step is turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Let my heart, let my harvest be rooted out. Now this is a biggie here. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, In other words, waiting for my neighbor to leave so I can get together with his wife. Then let my wife grind for another. Let my wife not be my wife anymore. Let she be somebody else's wife. And let others bow down over her. For that would be wickedness. And he knows adultery is wickedness. Now, we don't know exactly. Frank was asking about the law before the Mosaic law, where we are right now in Job. This was before the Mosaic law. What kind of a law was there? How did he know that adultery was bad? Well, I know he's speaking to the Lord, and I know the Lord talks to him. And, I mean, Cain was apprehended. Abel knew what righteousness was all about, knew what sacrifice was all about. And we really don't know. There wasn't the Mosaic law that said, for example, the speed limit is 25 miles an hour, so if you're going 26, you're breaking the law. Before that law came into existence, you could have gone 26 miles an hour and you would have never known it because you didn't know you were going over the law. But here he says, he basically, by his testimony, he knows the problem with adultery. And I'm just thinking about, you know, the pornography today is everywhere, and how important it would be for everyone to have a covenant with their eyes not to look upon a young person. So he goes on then and says, for adultery would be wickedness, that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be iniquity deserving of judgment. So here he is stating that he knows there's some kind of judgment out there, because he says it would be wickedness. Yes, it would be iniquity. Iniquity is doing something wrong, deserving of judgment. For that would be a fire that consumes to destruction, and it would root out all my increase. Well, all of the wickedness of the Amorites, which God gave them 800 or 400 years to get right, you know, that was all this idolatry and immorality. Idolatry and immorality has been there since the beginning. Those are two basic sin categories that are all the way through the Bible, before the law and after the law. It's still those two things that catches most of the sin under those two things. So he basically is saying that would be wickedness, it would be iniquity, deserving of judgment, meaning that he would be put to death. And actually, under the Mosaic law, it was a capital crime, adultery. You were to be stoned to death for that. Now, it wasn't codified there before the Mosaic law, but after the Mosaic law, it was. For that would be a fire that consumes destruction, would root out all my increase. If, here's another test now, if I have despised the cause of my male or female servants, if I've come against my help when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? I love that. Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? So he's saying, I'm looking at my servants. I'm rich, or I was rich. I had all this power and position, but they're just like me. They're made just the same way I was formed. Now, do you look at other people that way? Do you look at the unlovable that way? Do you look at the one standing on the corner begging for money that way? I don't know how to look at them, because I don't know whether they're telling the truth or whether they're not telling the truth. But it's hard in some cases not to kind of say, well, you know, I'm doing a little better than they are, kind of a thing. I mean, we have this carnal comparison all the time, don't we? And he's saying, I did not treat my help cruel, nor was I disinterested in them when they talked to me. I listened to them, and I recognized that they're made by the same maker, the same fashion that I made. And then he's talking about the poor here. What an example for us. Verse 16, if I have kept the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless could not eat of it, but from my youth I reared him as a father. In other words, he must be talking about an orphan or somebody. I don't know who's talking about there. From my youth I reared him as a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. So he has been kind to the orphans and the widows, it would seem to me. Verse 19, if I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, all these ifs, if he is not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless when I saw I had help in the gate. Now listen to this. Then let my arm fall from my shoulder. Doesn't sound like a guilty man to me, does it? If I've done any of these things, Lord, just tear my arm off. I mean, that's a pretty powerful position, isn't it? Let my arm be torn from the socket. Would I say that? I don't know. For destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence, I cannot endure. I just need to hear from him. I want to hear from him. If I have made gold my hope, if I have pursued riches, if I have made gold my hope, or said to find gold, you are my confidence, if I rejoice because my wealth was great, and because my hand has gained much, if I observe the sun when it shines, or the moon moving in brightness, in other words, if I'm worshiping the sun and the moon, and I haven't, many did in those days. Checked your astrology chart today, anybody? No, I hope not. So that my head has been secretly enticed, so that my heart has been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity deserving of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. So Job knows all of these things are sin, basically all these things are an iniquity deserving of judgment. And again, it's God's law, whatever form that is, that they would know that. For I would have denied God who is above. That's just a beautiful testimony, isn't it, to me anyway? He knows what God is and what God's heart is, and if he do these things, he's denying God's love. Anytime we sin, we're basically denying God's love, it seems to me. So he says, I would have done that, but he didn't do those things. If I've rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me. Ooh, now we're getting a little bit close to home here. Maybe that never happens to you. Maybe you're really happy with people who have a real problem that they've been mean to you. If I've rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me or lifted myself up when evil found him, indeed I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul. I don't think I've ever asked God to curse anybody. I don't know. I don't think much of that, so I don't think I've done that. You go to certain places like in Africa and all, boy, they're all into cursing. They put curses on everybody all the time, witchcraft and all that stuff. But here it's asking for a curse on his soul. He says no. If the men of my tent had not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his meat, but no sojourner had to lodge in the street, for I have opened my doors to the traveler. A remarkable statement again here. What an example his integrity is to me. I have covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom. Now that's an interesting statement, isn't it? So no Bible, but he still knows about Adam hiding in the garden and God coming to Adam and Eve and saying, Adam, where are you? Chapter 3 of Genesis now. He didn't have the Bible, but Adam wanted to hide his iniquity and God, you know, said, where are you? Why are you hiding? Why are you naked? Because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families so that I kept silence and did not go out the door. So he's saying, I've not covered my sin or tried to hide from the people or kept silent about my sin. He says, oh, that I had one to hear me. He just wants to hear from the Lord. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me. That my prosecutor had written a book. If I could just see God's book, what he's written about me, we could talk this out. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps, like a prince I would approach him. Wow. Now, all of this is based on what he knows. He doesn't have the New Testament like we have. He doesn't know about the resurrection yet. He doesn't know about the fact that we've been forgiven and saved. He doesn't know any of that yet. And he's just, this is from the heart, and it's of course before the time of Moses, before the law, and so forth. Verse 38. If my land cries out against me and its furrows weep together, if I have eaten its fruit without money, in other words, if I've stolen things to eat, or caused its owners to lose their lives, or if I've done something to cause somebody to die, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. And then these words, the words of Job are ended. I don't hear anybody saying, oh no, let's go on. Basically he's saying, I rest my case. So we really aren't going to hear much from Job again for a while. We're going to now move into Elihu, and we're going to have six chapters from him. And that's an interesting testimony that he has. And there's a lot of truthful things he says as well, but it's still pretty much the same basic thing that the other three guys had said. It doesn't really bring significantly new things to the table, but you can decide that on your own next time when we get together and go through that. So we covered a lot tonight, 120 verses. We'll cover Elihu next time as well, because I don't think there is all that much to be gained from spending an awful lot of time on these testimonies, because God doesn't think much of them. So if God doesn't think much of them, I don't think we need to spend an awful lot of time on them. We'll slow down a little bit when we get into the chapters where God starts to answer, and they are absolutely phenomenal. Some of the best chapters in the Bible, I think. Verse 1 of chapter 38 says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind," and so then the Lord will speak. And it is going to be an awesome thing. So we'll take our time there. When God is speaking, we want to listen, right? Not so much when man is speaking, unless he's really led by the Spirit. But when God is speaking, we want to listen. And then we will see what God thinks about these three friends. He didn't say anything about Elihu, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And then Job, of course, repents in a sense of now that he can talk to God. I mean, even if God's going to ask him all these questions and Job can't answer one of them, but he'll be down low, low, low. God is so exalted. And so we have some good chapters ahead of us here. And we'll look forward to that. So if you want to read ahead, read ahead. If you want to just wait and be surprised with what you see at the end, that's all right too. I've told you quite a bit about it already. Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you for this precious book, and it is so meaningful in so many ways to us. There's so much instruction here on how to comfort those who are really suffering. And before it's over, I think we will see kind of a renewed and kind of an expanded awareness of your awesomeness with respect to through and in creation. And we need to keep that in mind, I think, more than ever before, because that's the basis of everything. As we will see, all of the questions back to Job with all of this suffering is nothing about Job. It was all about you, in a way, and that's the way it is with each of us. So bless each one. I just pray for a blessed season during this Christmas time, and as we will have opportunities to meet with family, friends, and others. May those opportunities be great times of just showing your love and your joy and your living hope to those who are not yet yours. And may our presence, no matter to believers or unbelievers, be an encouragement and bring honor to you. In Jesus' name, amen.